This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Francesca Stanfill about The Falcon's Eyes. Like many young women, I first encountered Eleanor of Aquitaine through Katharine Hepburn's wonderful portrayal in The Lion in Winter. The more I learned about the Queen, the more she impressed me. So naturally, when I learned of Francesca Stanfill's new novel, based on Eleanor's life, I wanted to find out more. The Falcon's Eyes opens with Eleanor and later returns to her. In the interim, she hovers in the background, a character others talk and in some cases argue about. But the novel really focuses on Isabel, a countess from a family in Provence. She is the eye of the passage that follows. Fontevraud Abbey, Loire Valley, France. Thursday, the 1st of April, Anno Domini 1204. The Queen, my Queen, died shortly before dusk. Darkness has descended with her death, and with it all the warmth of her beloved Aquitaine. Her hand rests in mine, her fingers colder than the cloister's stone. Gently I draw the sable about her neck and shoulders. It has been a frigid month, and it comforts me to know the cloak will enshroud her still. She goes to a realm of radiance, they say, yet a desolate part of me fears it will be icy, lightless. Even for her, Eleanor, Queen of England and France, the fabled Duchess of Aquitaine. And now, please join me in welcoming Francesca Stanfill. Hi, Francesca. Thank you for agreeing to chat with me today.
Good morning, Carolyn, and I'm excited to talk to you about The Falcon's Eyes.
You have quite a long and varied career, including several previous novels. Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, I've had a life with a lot of variety. I was born in England. I grew up in New York City and then moved to California for high school. I went to college in the East, and then I began working 2 weeks after college as a reporter, first for the for Women's Wear Daily, and then for the New York Times Magazine. And at the end of my career at the New York Times Magazine, I began to write novels. My first was Shadows and Light, the story of an obsessive love affair, and then Wakefield Hall, which, though set in New York in the late 80s, had a very 19th century feeling. But throughout all of that time, and really from the time I was really a girl, I've always wanted to write an historical novel. I love history and the art, and I've always wanted to write a novel where I could bring a distant period to life. It was the idea of marrying research, scholarship with the imagination and invention and a strong, pulsating story, which drew me. For whatever reason, the past has always been a familiar country to me.
On your website, you mentioned that you have been fascinated by Eleanor of Aquitaine since 1969. Why is that?
I think I first became truly fascinated. I had read about her, but I think the first salvo was seeing the film The Lion in Winter in 1968, where she's portrayed by Katharine Hepburn. And the following year, I went on a family trip to France, and we visited the Abbey Fontevraud in the Loire Valley in central France, where she retired. She spent the last years of her life, which she patronized throughout her life, and where her tomb lies. And her tomb is full of mystery. It's a wonderful design. She probably designed it herself with her eye to her posthumous reputation. And she's depicted reading an open book. And I was fascinated by that. And after seeing Fontevraud, I began to read more about her. And what I learned just continued to pique my curiosity. She was the wife of two kings, the mother of two kings, and one of the great power players of the extraordinary 12th century. I think the other idea that fascinated me was that her life actually really spanned the entire century. She died in 1204, so she was 82 when she died, which is extraordinary in its own right, and made her something of a freak of nature. Beyond that, I would say, the more I read about Eleanor, the more I was in awe of her life. She was a patron of the arts. And she traveled widely. She had clearly an enormous sense of adventure. And she exemplified many qualities I think I admire. She was resilient. She was strategic in her thinking. She was indomitable. Of course, at times she was ruthless, but she had to be in order to survive.
Eleanor is certainly a character in The Falcon's Eyes. We see her at the beginning as she has just died, and we meet her as a character later on. But the main story is told from the viewpoint of Isabel, who is fictional, rather than Eleanor herself. What made you decide to use that different point of view?
Well, when I really embarked on writing the novel, was intent on writing it, I toyed with the idea of writing it from Eleanor's point of view, but I pretty quickly discarded that. I didn't want to see her from her point of view. I wanted to see her shot from all angles. And the reason why I felt so strongly about that was this. She was notorious even in her own time. She was famous. She was a famous heiress. She then became Queen of France, then Queen of England. And she ruffled a lot of feathers. There were people who reviled her and many others who revered her. I wanted to see her from all of those angles and all of her complexity. And for that, I would have to do it from another point of view, from the point of view of someone who knew her well, who was with her, and perhaps even from the point of view of a young woman to whom Eleanor had been a mentor. And that, of course, is my heroine, Isabel. And Isabel is with her. Isabel is with her the moment when she dies in that first scene.
Introduce us to Isabel. What is she like as a personality?
Well, she's a rebel like Eleanor, which partly explains why she's drawn to her. She is intensely curious, adventuresome. She loves learning. She is drawn to stories, to invention. One of her credos is, whenever you are in despair, invent. But I think she admires Eleanor most of all because she sees in Eleanor this woman who was fearless, who made her own way in life, who made her own rules, who was not controlled by others, and who was really quite extraordinary. I think in the early days of when Isabel is a girl, she is fascinated by Eleanor, partly because she hears about the queen from her mother, and her mother, who is a very cold and chilling character, thinks of Eleanor as the devil incarnate. And of course, Isabel, as a teenager, becomes even more fascinated by the queen because of that.
Indeed, Isabel is not entirely comfortable even within her own family, although she does get along pretty well with her grandfather and her brother. What can you tell us about the members of her family and her relationship with them?
Well, no one in her family understands her, really, except her slightly older brother, Arnaud, whom she adores, and her grandfather. Her mother and sister find her an unruly nuisance. Her oldest brother, Guy, who is something of a social climber, merely tolerates her. And whenever she can, Isabel escapes to the magical world of her grandfather's library, and he is her kindred spirit, really. He teaches her to read and write. And most of all, he values her thoughts, her mind, her imagination. The rest of the family really see Isabel, as so many young medieval women were seen, as a commodity to be bartered.
Her parents in particular are very glad when Gerard de Mortaigne accepts Isabel as his wife. It's expected, of course, that a young noblewoman living in the 12th century will marry. But what makes Gerard, in her parents' eyes, the ideal husband for Isabel?
Well, first of all, he is rich. And Isabel's family, though it is of ancient lineage, has a noble name, is not rich. And it chafes Isabel's mother, particularly, that they do not have the means for a luxurious life. You can feel within this mother that she sort of has her nose pressed against the glass. So he is rich and can provide for her daughter. And, of course, that is the number one attraction. He's willing to be wed to her, which thrills her mother, because the mother and to some extent the father fear that no one would want Isabel because she's can be disobedient. She has a mind of her own. And so this is a way for them to secure her future. And quite honestly, really, for them to get rid of Isabel. She really had no other options in life, except perhaps to go to a to an abbey. But even there, the family didn't really have the money to contribute to an abbey that would support her.
Yes, I think it's not generally understood that in the Middle Ages, in particular, you couldn't just join an abbey. You had to actually have the equivalent of a dowry even to become a nun.
Exactly. And Isabel's family was not in that position.
When Isabel first gets to Ravenur and meets her new husband, she's quite pleasantly surprised at first. What can you tell us about this early stage in her relationship?
Well, she is dazzled by the luxury of Chateau Ravenur. She's come from a manor house in the south of France, in Provence, which is a very simple place. There's a kind of stinginess about it when it's later described in the novel. It's a feeling of people who've made, it has rooms which I think I write reflect the owners who have made a great accommodation with life. Whereas Chateau Ravenur is full of luxuries. The food is copious. There are expensive spices. The walls are hung with silk tapestries. And most of all, it is very worldly. It's a reflection of Gerard's travels, of his entrancement with the East, with the Holy Land, with all of the luxuries of the world that he has seen in his travels. And so that at first is quite seductive. It is also a very stratified world, rather formal. There's a certain rigidity about it. And of all of the aspects of Chateau Ravenur, perhaps which fascinates Isabel the most, I would single out the muse, the scene where Gerard, who is obsessed with falconry, shows her his muse and his falcons, is among my favorite moments in the book. And these falcons, which are almost really part of the household and are very precious to Gerard, are a crucial element in the story.
Yes, they really are. And one of the elements of the story is that Isabel makes friends, some of whom Gerard considers inappropriate. One of them is Eglantine and also Galleon, who in turn, you know, eventually becomes involved with the Falcons. So what draws Isabel to these people whom her husband doesn't approve of?
They are comforting to her. She's lonely. Imagine this young woman, 17, coming to marry a man she's never met, going from a simple manor house to this grand place, and to a husband who is distant. He's fascinating, he's powerful, but he's rather distant and hard to read. So Eglantine, who is a sweet, slightly mysterious young woman, her servant, becomes her friend, her confidant, and then others like Galleon, the falconer, whom Isabel finds at once a very touching figure, because he's come from England. He's been brought over as a slave and sort of adopted by Gerard to work in the stables, but dreams of becoming a falcon, a master falconer. So there's a kind of, Isabel has a sympathy and a compassion for these two. And of course, they become friends. And that becomes an issue in her marriage to Gerard, because Gerard does not think it is appropriate for the lady of the household to become close to the servants. He feels that they are servants and that they must remain so. And I would say that when Isabel begins to realize this, and when he begins to bear down on her because of this, this begins a new and slightly disturbing part of her marriage.
A more suitable friend from Gerard's perspective, if only for a while, is Lady Fastrada. I loved Lady Fastrada. She's a wonderful character. Tell us about her.
Lady Fastrada is a marvelously flamboyant, stylish character who is another a rule breaker in a way, or at least unconventional in her thinking. And she comes to Ravenor with her husband Hugh for the hunt. And Gerard is very eager to curry her favor, because she's from they are very important noble people from Troyes. Hugh is another power player with the court, and since they are of ancient lineage, Gerard is very, very eager to be accepted by them. And at first, he promotes the friendship with Fastrada, between Fastrada and Isabel, but then I think becomes slightly wary of her, because Fastrada is also, she's stylish, she's witty, but she's also something of an agent provocateur. She talks to Isabel about, for example, bearing children. She says that she has sons, but she, as her life progressed, she did not want to be ruled by what she calls the tyranny of conception. She introduces the ideas to Isabel about perhaps not living this way, perhaps even about controlling her own body. Fastrada says, you know, she learned that if she became very thin and at a certain point she would not become pregnant. And all of this is rather shocking to Isabel. But she's also a very warm, warm woman and listens to Isabel and is curious about her. And she also tells Isabel about her sister. She has a sister who, a rather unlikely sister, because Fastrada, who is so worldly, so flamboyant, has a sister who is a nun, Clementia. And Clementia is a nun at the Abbey of Fontevraud. And she becomes, we are introduced to her later, and she is a very, very important figure in the story.
She is indeed. And of course, there's a present-day relevance to this I'm sure Girard would see it as undermining of the central purpose of marriage, because in the Middle Ages, that was really the only reason to be married, was to have children.
Yes, and the idea, I really want to emphasize that it is one of the themes of the book is control, various methods of control, you know, whether it's the husband over the wife, the falconer over the falcon, posthumous control, but also the issue of control over one's body as a young woman. And this is a very, very important issue in the book for Isabel. And I did a great deal of research about what was thought of then as methods of contraception and theories about conception, theories about, you know, what sex child you were going to have and all of this. And the details in the book all came from treatises, 12th century treatises, which were used at the time. Some of them, of course, as we read them, and these theories which are presented by the healer Amthusis in the book seem really quite wacky. But even then, women were striving to understand these issues and to grapple with them. It's a very important element of the story.
Let's go back to the falcons for a second. What do the falcon's eyes symbolize for you?
Well, the falcon's eyes change. The gaze changes according to circumstances and according to the perception of the viewer. And I think that's true. I think it's an element of complexity in the book, whether it has to do with the falcons or with the objects in the book or with, you know, even the rooms in the book, which change according to who sees them and when and what is associated with them. So the falcon's eyes are sometimes menacing, sometimes welcoming, sometimes the gaze comes as a warning. The falcons themselves, as I said, really do kind of encompass this wider theme of control, and also the theme of freedom. You know, the falcons are trained, and they can obey, and they are meant to obey, but they can also decide at their own will, with their own will, when they want to be free and never return. And when Isabel is first introduced, for example, to Girard's falcons, he also shows her his doves. And at the end of that scene, he says, "Ah, you are my dove." Well, as the book progresses, that is a question. Is Isabel really a dove, or is she, in fact, a falcon with a will of its own?
We're going to skip over what happens with the marriage because we don't want to give away spoilers. You've mentioned Clementia and Fontevraud, and if Isabel eventually does find her way to Fontevraud, what is it about this particular convent that draws her and makes her want to live there?
She has heard about it, first of all, and its affiliation with the Queen, with Queen Eleanor. She knows that Eleanor patronized Fontevraud. She has heard that it's an unusual abbey because it's run by the abbess. It's a dual-sex abbey. There are monks in one part and then the nuns in the other. But it is the abbess who rules, and that was according to the dictates of its founder, Robert Abricel, in the early 12th century. She also knows that there are learned noble women who live there, women who have had worldly experience and who are really, in effect, managers. That was also one of the fascinating aspects to me in learning about Fontevraud, that the founder, Abricel, was quite determined that the women in charge be women who had had experience in the world, that they be widows, that they be capable women. There were always royal affiliations with Fontevraud. It was wealthy. It had been patronized by Eleanor's family, as I said, and also by Henry II's family, the Plantagenets. So it had that aura of glamour, I suppose, to Isabel, and who is a romantic. And I think she does become fascinated by it, partly because of that. And also because she, initially because of that, and then even more fascinated, she becomes even more fascinated when she learns that Fastrada's sister, Clementia, is a nun there.
She's just settling in to Fontevraud when, again, circumstances lead her in a different direction. And she ends up boarding a ship to England, which is where Queen Eleanor enters the novel, really, as a first, as a living person. Where is the Queen at this point in her life, and why is she there?
The Queen is under house arrest in southern England between Salisbury and Windsor. We're not entirely sure, you know, where exactly she was, but she was in that region. She had been thrown in house arrest, captured by Henry II in 1173. I'll just backtrack a moment and explain. In 1173, in the early 1170s, Eleanor and her sons, impatient with Henry and his need to control and his ruthlessness, incited a rebellion against him. And Eleanor was very much blamed for having sided with her sons against their father. That was really unheard of. And in 1173, she was captured and sent over the Channel to England. She remained under house arrest for 16 years. And it is during that time when Isabel meets her. So we do meet her in the middle of the novel in England. In the first part of the novel, Eleanor sort of hovers over the book in much the way that Rebecca hovers over the Daphne du Maurier novel. We hear about her from all points of view. And then finally, in the middle, we meet her in England. And Isabel has been sent as a companion to her, as it appears in history, several young women from Fontevraud were. So I always was fascinated to imagine Eleanor at this time, because I thought of this woman who had traveled, who had been on the Second Crusade, who had negotiated with kings, and who had really been, as I said earlier, such a power player. And then I thought of her for 16 years under house arrest in a court in exile, with every move watched by her wary husband. And that is exactly the time, of course, when Isabel finally meets her.
And that's also the time, the setting of Lion in Winter is during that period of imprisonment
exactly,
as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Eleanor and Isabel hit it off almost right away. What draws them together?
They're drawn together, I think, by their spirits, by their minds, by their curiosity. And I think they recognize in each other they have a complicity of spirit. They are both intelligent. They are both unconventional. When Eleanor first meets Isabel, she challenges her. She puts her she's not put her at her ease at all. She tests her, and Isabel comes through that test. However nervous Isabel is, imagine this young woman being brought to these chambers and in this formidable castle in England, being brought to this great queen who sits in her, you know, sort of improvised throne. And they're drawn together by their love of learning and by stories. And I think it's partly through the books that Eleanor reads, that they read together, the stories of Eleanor's life that she begins to tell Isabel, which of course fascinate her. Those are all the things that draw them together. And Isabel, to a great extent, also becomes something of a surrogate daughter to her. Eleanor is isolated. She does not see her children, her own daughters, or across the Channel, her daughter Matilda in Saxony, her daughter Leonora in Spain, her other daughter, her youngest daughter, perhaps her favorite, Joanna, in Sicily. So in a way, Isabel becomes that substitute daughter for her, and something of a mother figure. albeit a formidable mother figure.
But not as formidable as Isabel's own mother in many ways.
No, not as formidable as Isabel's own mother, who would be right up there, I think, with Lady Macbeth in terms of the warmth department.
Yeah, she definitely would be. This is a long novel, although it doesn't feel long, and you must have done an absolute ton of research, although, again, it folds right into the story, so I'm very impressed by that. Before we close, have I left anything out that you would like listeners to hear about? Characters, plot points, settings, something that's particularly dear to you?
Well, I want to emphasize that it is a big tapestry with a wide range of characters, with servants, noblewomen, nuns. I also, there are certain aspects I'd also like to mention. One is the idea, a very important theme of the book, the idea of women working together and the power of friendships among women. And it is a story that I think brings history to life, this period to life, this brilliant century to life, Eleanor to life. But it is also a story that I think derives its power because it is one of great feeling and emotion. And although many have emphasized the depiction of the relationship, the friendship, the complicity between Isabel and Eleanor, I also want to emphasize that what gives the story its suspense and its drama is Isabel's need not only to outwit, but also to escape the vengeance of someone she has crossed. And that really lies at the core of The Falcon's Eyes. I won't tell you who that person is. you'll have to read The Falcon's Eyes to find out.
Yes, I mean, there's so many layers to the story that we can't go into because they would give away other things. But Isabel is not the only person who has to worry about the vengeance of that particular character.
Yes, and as I say, it's a complex book with a big tapestry. There's the upstairs, downstairs. It's a story of families. It's a story of a marriage. Most of all, I hope it will really transport the readers into this other world and make it come alive for them.
This book has just come out. Are you already working on something new?
I am. I'm working on a novel set in the late 19th century, another brilliant century, complex in time, with a very different kind of narrator, a book really that will focus on status, money, self-invention, and I think will be a rather perhaps a dark, mysterious book with a kind of Hitchcockian feeling.
That's a whole other research program you've got
yes.
there.
I love research.
Do you?
I love research, and I love the mix of research and the magic of a story, of invention.
Yes, I must admit, I love research too. But how do you decide what to keep in and what to leave out?
It's very hard. Part of it is just instinct. Part of it is just at a certain point you have to say no enough, because research is very seductive. If you love to learn, as I do, you could go on and on forever. And it's a challenge for me because I love history. I love details. I love art. I'm very visual. I mean, Falcon's Eyes is full of art and objects and all the things of rooms and all the things that bring a period to life. Not only ideas, not only personalities, but the whole mise en scène. So it can be seductive, but at a certain point, you do really have to say, okay, now I've just got to get to it. And another thing that works is when your agent calls and says, enough is enough, you've got to get going.
That always helps, right?
That helps.
Well, I want readers to listeners to hear that you really did a wonderful job. And although the research has to be there because otherwise you couldn't come up with all those details, it really is a wonderful read. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today, Francesca.
Thank you, Carolyn, very, very much.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Francesca Stanfill about The Falcon's Eyes. Find out more about her at francescastanfillauthor.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Network. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.